This is Ike Arumba from Ike Arumba and the Infidels and the Ike Arumba Show on Code Zero Radio. It's time to get into the music.
Today's show is brought to you in part by WCZR Code Zero Radio, your go-to for the best alternative and indie music. Find them at live.codezeroradio.com or download the free Code Zero Radio app. And now, let's get into the music.
Well, hello, everyone. This is Rob, and thanks for tuning in to Into the Music. Whether you're a regular listener or hearing Into the Music for the first time, please consider subscribing to the show. This helps to keep the podcast going, and you'll be sure not to miss an episode. Subscribers will get a shout-out, an appearance on the show, and get early access to each episode. Just go to intothemusic.com for more information. That's intothemusic.com. Well, if you follow Into the Music on Facebook or Instagram, then the name Ike Arumba should be familiar to you. Ike fronts his own band, Ike Arumba and the Infidels. He plays bass with others. He writes, he records, and he hosts the Ike Arumba Show, which is on Tuesday evenings on Code Zero Radio. He's an attorney and has a life story, which music plays a huge part. And so with that, I welcome Ike Arumba to the show. How's everything there at Chimphaven Studio, high atop Hobart Mountain, Ike?
Well, things are going pretty well. I think I'm feeling a little bit chimpy right now, but life is good. I'm a little bit flummoxed. I went to the doctor yesterday. There's been a terrible mix-up. Turns out I've got Alzheimer's disease, and he's got mine. So we're trying to straighten that out. And about a month ago, I finally had a complete neurological examination, following my brain injury and my coma. And they compared me to attorneys and doctors of my age. And I did really, really well, on the upper end of the bell curve, except in one area where I really flunked out big time. And that was attention span. So, hopefully I can get. What were we talking about? Well, anyway, hopefully I can get through this thing. But yeah, life is good. I'm as good as we can expect.
Cool. Now, I know folks out there are wondering about this, but what's up with the chimp theme?
Well, the chimp thing, it's legitimate. I'll give you the short answer and the long answer. The summary is that about one third of the time in my life, I'm asleep. And when I'm asleep, like everyone else, the dreams are the reality. So that's my reality, whatever I'm dreaming. The other two-thirds of the time are, my waking hours are pretty much equally split. About one-third of the time, I'm a chimp that thinks he's a man. And about the other third of the time, I'm a man that thinks he's a chimp. Well, how did this come to be? Well, years ago, as I was slogging through 80-plus hours a week, fighting other people's battles, chasing money, kind of ignoring the basic fundamentals of life, things went very wrong, very wrong. Someone I loved very much died horribly. I was told I got chronic shock just from living through it. And, I'd already seen enough of human existence and the self-centered, amazingly stupid ways of people in the business world and otherwise. And I kind of defaulted. I guess I just dropped everything, my career, my belongings, my ambitions, most of my clothes, most of my humanity. I kind of went full on chimp and kind of set up my life in the jungle canopy where I lived as a chimp in the society of chimps. And I came to realize that it is a jungle out there in human life, but that the jungle of chimp life is more honest and worthy and pure than the human existence, with the human preoccupations on money and politics and artifice and mental misdirection plays to gain power. And, some doctors claim I went delusional that I wasn't a chimp, but how do they know? Are dreams not very much reality at the time, right? Well, does anybody really know what they really are or where they really are or what reality is? I submit to you that we don't. As for humanity, well, I think that humanity is truly in the eye of the beholder, and I'll take chimpitude any day. So, yeah, I'm chimpy. I've got a foot in each canoe, human and chimp, and I think it's a good thing. I really do. So, That's kind of the story on me with the chimp thing. And call me nuts if you will, but I know it's good for me.
Well, you have a pretty deep musical history that covers playing in everything from a polka band to your own band called Ike Arumba and the Infidels, which plays some of the loudest, crunchiest stuff I've come across. Now, where did you get your start as a musician and eventually as a performer?
Well, I got my start as a musician growing up in the 1960s, where, you know, rock and roll really hit the scene with the Beatles and the Stones and Paul Revere and the Raiders and the Birds. And, you know, we had three channels on TV back then, and I was just a young, impressionable child, and I very much believe that what we drag across people's psyches on TV has a profound impact. And for me, it was watching these rock bands on TV. And I would dream of being in a rock band. I would dream of being up on a stage and not knowing the song. I'm looking at a leopard skin hanging in my room right now that was in my dreams, draped over a keyboard player's keyboards. So I was imbued in this musical television culture as a child, which included, by the way, Lancelot Link in the Evolution Revolution from the TV show Lancelot Link, Secret Chimp. And maybe that's what started the chimp thing, but we start out with this relatively primitive rock and roll, Ed Sullivan Show and the whole bit. And all the way through my high school in the 1970s, by the 1970s, it was, you know, Deep Purple, Montrose, Sweet, Rush, and bands like that. But that really left a mark on me. And then about 15 years of age, I ended up playing in a polka band, a very well-known regionally, if not nationally popular polka band, and did a lot of touring around. And, you know, played in my little high school rock band and went to college and kept playing guitar at nights when I wasn't studying. Same thing with law school. But I got my start playing in a polka band where I played bass guitar, a wonderful instrument, and learned the fundamentals of the instrument. And I'm glad I did. And polka has left a mark on me, no doubt about it. But so did the Sex Pistols as well.
All right. Well, you have some past experience in the Madison music scene. In a sense, by day, you attended the University of Wisconsin to get a degree in English Lit, and then you went on to get your law degree there. And by night, you were the gigging musician. So what was the music scene like in Madison back then?
Well, it was a wonderful eye-opener for me. I came from a small town in northern Wisconsin where my musical experience, other than playing in a polka band, was, you know, working in a gas station and listening to the late-night FM music. And I didn't really see a lot of live bands in high school. And I went down to Madison in 1977, and there were wonderful, regionally popular bands like Bad Boy, Punch, The Verz, Spooner, Leslie Thriller. Ron and Linda from that band lived right next to me for a while. We were good friends. They had these wonderful venues like Headliners, the Church Key, Shuffle In, Windjammer, the Red Rock. The University of Wisconsin was right there with all its music, and they had their big Memorial Union Rathskeller. There was a place called the Rafters down by the football stadium. The Stone Hearth, Bucky's, all kinds of wonderful places. You know, the first couple of weekends down there, it had to be in the first month, I went down to a place a block away from my dormitories called the Stone Hearth. And I saw a band that was new on the scene called AC/DC for $2. They had just released their seminal album, Let There Be Rock. And that just about floored me. There I was standing 10 feet from that band, staring at them, you know, 18-year-old kid, completely blown away. Cheap Trick was big on the scene back then. Patrick McDonald and the Essentials were playing around there. Patrick McDonald is still a big name in Wisconsin. I saw bands like the Motels at an upper floor bar on State Street called the Red Rock that was set up like a cave. They had some kind of foam that was painted red all over the walls and with red lights on it. It was like you're in a cave. And I saw the Motels there for just a couple of dollars. Right when they became famous, there were bands like the Suburbs coming through, as well as a lot of national acts at the Dane County Coliseum, like Fleetwood Mac, for example. But it was music central, probably the most happening music scene in the Midwest, unless you wanted to include Chicago for blues, or possibly Minneapolis, which was much better then than it is now. But it was Nirvana. It was Nirvana for a music lover.
Sure. Well, that law degree that you got at the UW got you relocated to Seattle for a time, and it was in time for the grunge movement out there. Now, was that something that you dialed into right away?
Well, not right away, because believe it or not, I got there right before the grunge scene hit. When I got there in 1984, the grunge scene wasn't there yet, and it was a bad music town. even famous artists like Roger Fisher from Heart. I saw his band called Ten Bulls the first New Year's Eve I was out there. They were playing at a place called Astor Park, which was like sort of a restaurant bar. They had to pay the venue. Even he had to pay the venue money to play there. And then you'd try to get your money back at the door. It was a real dog of a music town. Then suddenly things exploded with Sub Pop Records and Nirvana and Mudhoney and all those bands. And the way I got involved in it, I still had this love of music, but I was a trial lawyer and it was a very time consuming job, but I still wanted to have that music in my life. I didn't have the time to play in a band. I didn't even really have time to listen to the radio. But there was the Art Institute of Seattle in Seattle, and they had a music video business department that was run by a man named Rick Knotts, who was a lead guitarist in a band called Rail that had just recently won the MTV Basement Tapes contest. That was back when MTV was just starting and just played nothing but music and didn't have all the weird programming. And I thought there'd be a great way for me to learn the ins and outs of the music business was to become a teacher for recording contracts, because then I'd have to learn it and I'd have to know it really well. And Rick Knotts hired me, and I became the first legal instructor for recording contracts and negotiations at the Art Institute there. Now, Roger Fisher from Heart was teaching publishing at the time. That's how I got to meet him and got to play a guitar with him, for example. And being the young lawyer, a lot of these established musicians were really nice to me and kind of took me under their wing, because I think it was nice for them to know a lawyer that they could talk to without getting a bill sent to them every time. And I was just absolutely delighted to be anywhere near that. And this music scene just exploded around me. And it wasn't just grunge. Grunge was really the big, big, big corporate interest that latched onto it. And by the way, there's a movie called Hype, H-Y-P-E, which I recommend. If you want to understand the Seattle grunge scene, watch the movie Hype. It's a wonderful, interesting eye-opener about the grunge scene in Seattle and how it took off. But, you know, we had bands like Fifth Angel on CBS Records. We had kind of funk bands like the Hungry Crocodiles. Heart was more or less based out of Seattle at the time, too. There was a lot going on. Blind Melon. But the Alice in Chains, the Nirvanas, these guys were kind of getting started, kind of working their acts and getting their musicianship together at the time. I remember having Alice in Chains' demo tape on a cassette, which they don't do anymore, across my desk at one point. And, you know, the thing is, I hated grunge right away. You know, I'd been playing in cover bands and playing radio hits, and this grunge stuff, I didn't understand it. I did come to love it eventually, and I became very good friends with some of them. But teaching at the Art Institute kind of tied me into some of these things. And I started doing some speaking for the Washington Volunteer Lawyers for the Arts at their seminars. And I learned the ins and outs. I represented Roger Fisher from Heart for a while. I represented James Byrd of Fifth Angel. And just working with the recording contracts and such, I learned a great deal. And to the extent that Seattle had entertainment lawyers, I was probably one of the two that was there. So I developed a lot intellectually in the music business and became friends with some people that I got to play guitar with as well. I saw Mother Love Bone, which was Pearl Jam, in a bar before they were Pearl Jam, for example. Alice in Chains, I remember them in a place called the Gibson House watching my band perform. I couldn't believe it. The Nirvana guys would be at parties and such. So I was dancing around the edges of this. Pearl Jam's manager consulted with me over lunch, for example. I represented some grunge bands like Willard. It was just a lot of fun. I remember I had one act with me and Willard's lead singer. It was called the Electric Pickle Experience, Mr. Liquor and Electric Pickle Experience. And we would take a big pickle, strip the ends off a couple of extension cords and kind of hang it behind us and plug it in, and the pickle would glow green. And that's how I met Blind Melon's bass guitarist, for example, because the pickle was more popular than the band. Years later, people remembered the pickle and forgot about us. But a guy named Brad came up, introduced himself to us. And I look at those now as the good old days, just music everywhere, going out and having a blast. And first I was just the guy teaching the recording contract class. Then later on, I got a little bit better known as the lawyer. And it was a lot of work, like I said, 80 hours a week, because I was doing a lot of big-time litigation. I was a construction lawyer. I was the lawyer for the prime contractor and its bonding company for the Kingdome Roof litigation, for example. I was winning trials for underwriters at Lloyd's of London. a lot of the big weird cases, those were my cases, and I was the trial lawyer's trial lawyer. I probably won over 98% of my cases. But the music stuff was the fun stuff. Those were the guys I hung out with. Wonderful times. I do miss them.
Well, I'm guessing just by listening to your album that that whole Seattle scene had a pretty profound influence on you as a player and a writer. Is that fair to say?
Yes, it kind of taught me something. There was this band called Willard. I remember Road Racer Records calling me up and saying, Jules Kearse, he was their New York player.
We'll be right back after this short break.
Is real music dying? What even is real music, and who are we to judge that? Well, my father is a lifelong musician, and together we've been making music for over a decade. In our new podcast, we dare to ask the urgent, the weird, and the deep questions, and we have a lot of wild stories to tell. No matter what genres you enjoy, whether you're a musician, a producer, or a listener, we invite you to discover unconventional perspectives on music. So tune in, and go follow Mad Makings of Music wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hey, Paul, we gotta get a Seattle band. We gotta get a Seattle band, you know? It's this grunge scene. We're missing out on the grunge scene. We gotta get a Seattle band, you know? But we want some a little bit more mainstream. Well, Willard, the girlfriend who was Marianne Braden, the bass guitarist with a major label recording act, a Warner Brothers act called Green Apple Quickstep, her boyfriend was in Willard. They ended up giving me a call, and they were looking for a lawyer to help them get a record deal. And I listened to their grunge tape, and this was back when I didn't like grunge very much at first. And I thought, oh my gosh, I can't do anything with this. I don't get it. I don't like it. And then Road Racer called me looking for a grunge band. I didn't send him Willard. Then a week or two later, Willard called me up, a guy named Mark Spiders, and he says, Road Racers contacted us and they want to sign us. And I thought, holy crap, I should have sent him that tape. But I ended up representing the band instead of the label on that one. And I think we got them the biggest advance Road Racer had ever paid anybody. Now, this was when Grunt Truck and other bands were coming out, really making a splash, as well as a Sub Pop crew. And these guys became my friends. I started to appreciate their music. But here's what stuck with it in terms of songwriting, right? Everyone has their own set of talents. At first, I thought of these grunge guys as a bunch of losers that couldn't play guitar. And let me tell you something. I did put people on record labels who could not play guitar. Just like Kurt Cobain wasn't much of a singer, but once they get the record deal, they send him off to the voice coach. A lot of these guys, and you'll see this with Alice in Chains, really exploded as musicians once they got their deal. Well, what I noticed about these guys was they didn't give a shit about the corporate stuff. They just wanted to play guitar. They just wanted to do what they loved, and they wanted to do it their way. And it occurred to me that there are people in Holiday Inns all over America that were better than major label recording artists. But they sounded just like major label recording artists. I used to tell my clients, if you can sing just like Michael Bolton, good for you. You're never going to get the big time because everyone's going to buy Michael Bolton instead of you. And here's these grunge guys. A lot of them are used to failing in life, quite frankly. And they didn't give a shit whether they failed or not in music. They just did what they loved. And all of a sudden, that glass ceiling was removed. At least they had a chance of making it big because they were different. They were unique at the time. And if it clicked, by golly, the sky was the limit. And that taught me to stop listening to the radio, trying to sound like somebody else or trying to master someone else's technique, and to just embrace myself, to be myself musically. And that was a lesson in life, too. And like I said, some of these grunge guys are still my very, very best friends in life. I really appreciate where they're coming from. And they taught me something they couldn't teach me in law school. They taught me something the president of the Hanson Industries couldn't teach me. This is really valuable stuff. So I started just being myself. In fact, when I first started, I couldn't sing that well, I think. And I just wrote songs so I didn't have to sound like Rod Stewart or somebody else. But I have songs like Cassiopeia, Astronomica, definitely, definitely grunge influenced, no question about it. And it was from sitting there in the room watching these guys play, saying, wow, they're just pulling the string and being themselves. And I can do that. I can do that. Mm-hmm. And that one of the best things I ever learned.
Cool. Well, let's listen to a track from your album, which is self-titled, Icarumba and the Infidels. The album was recorded at Rock Garden Studio with Mark Goldie handling the production and engineering. Tell us a little bit how the album came together and what's behind the humor of many of your lyrics.
Well, I had been performing for probably 6 or 7 years as Icarumba and the Infidels with my original band. We started out playing every weekend just about for $300 and $400 gigs just to try to get to be known. And coming in from Seattle as an unknown, it was very difficult. I couldn't get a phone call returned really from hardly any musicians or any venue. So we really slogged it out. And all my life I'd been, you know, writing parts of songs. So I had this big box full of parts of songs. And this was, you know, where I decided, screw it, I'm going to be different. Everyone said it's death to try to play originals in bars. Well, I was going to do it anyway. And we'd play about a dozen of our originals every gig. And people would leave the room humming my song, telling me they like my song, instead of the Bachman Turner Overdrive song, for example. And I didn't know Mark Goldie, but I had seen on Facebook and such that he's, you know, winning virtually every award that can be won. And everyone spoke highly of him. And we decided, well, what the heck, let's put an album out, because really it was all about street credibility. Having albums out makes you seem more legit. So I called up Mr. Goldie. He was good enough to take us in. And we'd been playing these songs a lot anyway, so we just went in, and it was pretty much two-take thing. We'd play a track, and I would sing along to it kind of half-heartedly, and then we'd come back, and then I'd do a serious vocal track over it. But I'll never forget the first song we played with Mark, because it was a little bit intimidating because Mark has got some credentials himself. And we had, you know, my amp in a different room and the bass amp in another different room and me and the bass player with the headphones on in there with the drummer. And we whipped through the music part of Irene. And as soon as we were done from the control room, we heard Mr. Goldie say, "Fuck yes." And that was so uplifting, so uplifting. And we just cranked through it, and there it was. And as for the humor in it, I don't know, that just comes from me. You know, I started out as a class clown when I was a little kid in school. I remember getting thrown out of Sunday school too. And that's, I guess that's just the way my head works.
Sure. Well, folks, here's Icarumba and the Infidels with Zombie Farm.
Now, there's some grunge influence in that one too.
Come on, come on, come on. top of the crop on a zombie farm. Can you hear the corn sneaking up on a hot summer morn? Will you yield to the field on a zombie farm? Come on.
Well, Ike, this album isn't your first recorded work. I recall you mentioning a while back that you actually had songs that were hits in Australia. And, you know, speaking of Australia, shout out to the Dodge City Social Club down there in Birdwoodton. I'm going to get this right. VIC, there in Outback Australia. What can you tell us about the songs that were hits down there?
Well, let me first give a shout out of my own to Pitbull Guitars, one of my sponsors. They sponsor me as an artist, the wonderful people. If you know, if they basically sell parts of guitars to people who are better at putting guitars together than me, because I tried and didn't do so well. But anyway, yeah, I've done other recordings. I did an album once under my own real name, which happened to coincide with the real name of a much more famous jazz artist who's still alive. And I got a letter from them, and it turns out they own the name. That was called Jamming with the Aliens, and it was an intergalactic themed CD, and it's got some really good stuff on it. I think it might still be available out there on CD Baby or something, but the problem with it was that I engineered it myself, and I was no Mark Goldie. So to me, that's kind of a drawback, so sometimes I shake my head when I listen to that. But as far as the Australian matter goes, that's the Icarumba and the Infidels album. And, you know, I'm not going to call them hits because, you know, when you got bands like AC/DC and Angel City and Olivia Newton-John coming out of there, you know, I more than pale in comparison. But I did get to spend a couple of weeks on the charts with at least three, maybe four songs off the album in Canberra, the capital. I had number one for 2 weeks with Meltdown. I think I was number four or so with Irene for a couple of weeks. The duet Strange Love Thing made number nine, and I can't remember if Zombie Farm was one that got up there too, but of course I was just tap dancing with glee that I was getting any attention anywhere. And I actually planned on going there to do some touring because I thought it'd be great to perform in Australia, but then COVID hit and that shut down everything, and prices skyrocketed at that time and since then as well, so I don't know that I'll ever get there. But I do get some international and local airplay. But by golly, I charted in Canberra. And that, to me, that's a feather in my hat.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, let's go from hit singles down under to playing bass for one of Wisconsin's polka kings, Alvin Staczynski. Now, you brought it up before that this is kind of where you cut your bass playing teeth. And you know, now, Alvin played more in the Polish tradition than the Bohemian Czech oompa style of, say, Dick Rogers, who was the other polka king of Wisconsin. Now, is that what attracted you to play for him, was that Polish polka?
No, you know, I didn't know polka from a hole in the ground. And I was working in a gas station for about $3.50 an hour. And then this guy who was about 6 foot tall, weighed about 120 pounds, a beanpole with a perm, tight, curly little perm, comes walking in. His name was Mark Selly. As I recall, Mark was interested in one of my elder sisters at the time. But anyway, Mark walked in. And, you know, I had seen Alvin Staczynski and his TV recording orchestra on the television set on Sunday mornings. And you'd see his posters all over the place. Because, yeah, he was regionally, if not nationally, very well known. And you're right, Dick Rogers was the other band that was a big deal with the other more German style. But anyway, this beanpole with a perm walks in and he says, "How'd you like to play bass guitar with Alvin Staczynski?" And I laughed and said, "No way." And then he said, $37.50 an hour plus road time. And I said, sign me up, because I really was interested in making money at the time. And I did like playing bass guitar. So really it was agreed. And I didn't know anything about polka styles or anything else. And the next day, Mark came in with a stack of about 15 albums. He said, here, learn the songs. So I took them home. About four or five songs into it, I started to realize that the bass parts were pretty similar in all these songs. And by golly, I could do it. So I ended up playing bass with the band. And it's right. We didn't have a tuba. It was bass guitar. Luckily for me, I even got to play a bass solo during In the Mood. But, you know, Alvin, we played waltzes, two-steps, schottische, different kinds of songs, different kinds of Polish dancing. And Alvin was very, very good to me, very friendly, very supportive. I think I was about 15, maybe 16 when I started. They taught me how to drink beer like a fish. They taught me how to play sheephead. We toured all over the place. But very much in the Polish format, Alvin sang in Polish many songs. He taught me to sing some parts in Polish. Moja jedzie kredzie kocha, I even remember a lot of these lines that I was singing. He added an SKI to my last name so I would seem more Polish too. So I kind of fell into it. It was a tremendous band. We had a phenomenal trumpet player, clarinet, fiddle, you know, as well as drums, two concertina players, and me on bass. And it really did allow me to hone my skills, and it gave me a foundation for playing the bass that I still rely on. And through Alvin, I got to play with Little Wally, who was an international polka star of the 50s and the 60s. Just never a bad time, always a pleasant hootenanny. And we had busloads of first generation Polish people following us around from gig to gig. And these people, holy mackerel, do they know how to party. They'd be, you know, getting all dressed up in their red and white dresses and flinging the hankies around over their heads and, you know, 3-day weddings and everything else, playing for multimillionaires. I was a lucky young man to be in that band. And what kind of smarted was when the Austrian government invited Alvin to be an official Oktoberfest band in Kitzbühel, Austria. Alvin put together a tour, a European tour. And I had to decide between going to Madison for college or going on tour with Alvin. And that was not an easy decision. But I went to college, and that's when I parted ways with Alvin. And Alvin went on for many years. And I believe he passed away about a year and a half or a year or so ago. It's just a wonderful, wonderful experience. I recommend it to anybody. Join a polka band.
Now, back in the day, you know, we already established that Alvin and Dick Rogers were basically the polka kings of Wisconsin. So basically, they were the heads of rival polka gangs.
Oh, yes.
Now, did you guys ever engage in any kind of polka brawls or polka thuggery or anything like that? Accordions, clarinets, tubas going airborne?
We didn't talk a lot about Dick Rogers around Alvin. We just figured it might be not a happy subject. But, you know, I think a polka off, a head-to-head polka competition would have been a gas, but our followers would have killed each other even if the bands hadn't. I often thought about, you know, sneaking over to one of Dick Rogers' gigs and letting the air out of their bus tires or something like that. It was a thought that was well received by everyone in the band when I'd float that kind of stuff. So I think they were kind of encouraging me because I was the minor. I wouldn't spend much time in jail if I got caught. But I can see the thing about violence and who wins the brawl has a lot to do with who drinks the most. And polka music involves a lot of drinking. I remember a guy named Stosh from a band I played in called the Happy Schnapps Combo here in Wisconsin, a very popular band. They wrote The Bears Still Suck, which has sold a zillion copies. And I remember their famous line, "We ain't leaving till we're heaving." And so it might depend on, I relish the thought of a polka brawl. I think it could be as hilarious as it could be, you know, painful. And I don't know whether Alvin's band would have won or whether Dick Rogers' band would have won. I think, you know, when it comes down to my respective instruments, me versus their tuba player, I have no doubt that I would have kicked the guy's ass because, I mean, let's face it, a bass guitar is a much better weapon than a tuba. But, you know, this is the stuff that really is left to conjecture. It might make a good scene in a movie.
Right. Well, since we're talking about polkas, your song Yee Hee Hee from your album is really, it's a polka, and it's pretty darn fun to boot. So tell us about it.
Well, he is borrows quite heavily from the Polka. I mean, the title kind of says it all. I often open the show with Yee Hee Hee, and it's like a bolt of lightning, the smiles you see flashing through the crowd, because people start smiling and laughing, and they just can't believe what they're hearing because it's so silly. But that's part of what music is all about, you know, unabashed revelry, unapologetic, happy silliness. Now, Yee Hee Hee, it's kind of a reflection of the confusion in my head, my inability to settle down and just do one thing or just be on one track. You know, on the allegorical level, I think of Yee Hee Hee as a bus full of grunge hippies driving into a truckload of polka pox. It's just an undisciplined mishmash of totally different genres. Like I said, unabashed revelry coming at you from two different angles that would normally seem inconsistent. Yet this thing works, and it makes people happy. And in its own way, it kind of demonstrates that we're all the same. Ike Arumba here from the Ike Arumba Show on Code Zero Radio. Do you know you can make yourself happy just by controlling what you drag across your psyche? So stop staring at that toxic screen and just put your ears to work. Listen to the Ike Arumba Show on Code Zero Radio, live at 8 p.m. on Tuesdays on Code Zero Radio and on demand.
Well, Ike, I'm going to turn a corner here. And some years ago, you had a major accident where you suffered a degree of trauma to your brain. Now, we'll get to how music played a part in your recovery in a bit, but give us a snapshot of what happened to you to set it up.
Well, I don't really fully know what happened. My brain tells me that it was time for me to die. I guess it was a one-car accident on a Christmas morning. One way or another, I ended up off the road and into the trees. And, you know, at some level, people intervened and somehow I lived. But I broke my neck two ways right underneath the skull in a bad place for neck breaks. I broke my shoulder. I had a traumatic brain injury and bleeding in the brain. And I was in a coma for, I don't know, a couple of weeks. And it was just a terrible, terrible experience. Yeah, there was some lengthy recovery time after that once I got home, you know, where I was wearing metal headgear and that sort of thing. But it was a terrible experience for me that I'd probably rather die than go through, where, you know, I was at some point, the coma involves a lot of delusions. And I don't know if it's coming out of the coma or during the coma, but I have memories that one might have been when I first got to a hospital. They flew me in a helicopter. And I remember thinking I was in a dentist's office behind the reception area, and that the people were very angry at me, and that I'd done something bad to some girl, and they were going to get even with me. And I remember getting up and someone grabbing me by the shoulder with their hand and throwing me back down on my back. And that was probably me trying to get up off the table when they first brought me in, and some doctor, you know, trying to hold me down. Then from there, I remember being in some sort of recovery room and thinking I had escaped because I thought I was being held captive. Then I remember being in like a caged bed in a bar, which then later on was a Chinese restaurant where someone would be watching me. And I was, afraid they were going to kill me. I was hearing that they were going to kill me, and I was always trying to escape. And I think the hallway I must have thought was Main Street on Green Bay, because I was constantly trying to escape to get out to that road, which wasn't a road at all. I had, hallucinations of a dead lady and her dead daughter in that bed with me, and people talking about how they were going to kill me. I recalled thinking that this cage they had me in had a removable lid, which it didn't. I remember crawling up with my hands, getting up to the top and trying to move the top off, and then falling down on my face and laying there exhausted and trying again and again to crawl off the top of this thing, which it turns out didn't have a removable top. Well, I was doing this with a neck that was broke two different ways. So they ended up tying me to the bed, and I was just fighting and resisting, fighting for my life, trying to escape. And because I was completely delusional, hearing things that weren't happening. Absolutely terrifying. I mean, I was pretty much as scared as a person could be. And eventually, I slowly came out of it and got to the point where I could recognize people in the room better, but couldn't talk. But I came out of it okay, but it was just a wretched experience. And I've spoken to other people who've been in comas too, and they also had very bad memories where, you're just detached from reality. You don't know what's going on, and your brain puts together a scenario that's not right. But I was not a good patient. I was not compliant. I thought they were going to kill me, and I was doing everything I could to get the heck out of there. That was just a nasty experience. I know my shoulder got busted all the way through, too, and they forgot to tell me about that. So, I came home and started trying to rehabilitate with push-ups on a broken shoulder. So, not a good experience at all. And, to this day, I had that neurological examination a while ago, and I've got some attention span issues and such. But I have taken the position that you can always improve your brain. And what I've read indicates that doing something challenging that you love is good for the brain. And, for someone like me, needs to work on trying to ward off dementia just in case. And exercise is great for that. I swim every morning almost. And also music is great for that because it is challenging and I do enjoy it. So the music is a big, big part of the therapy. And the funny thing is, I have lost memories. I have holes in my consciousness, so to speak. But I remember every word of all the songs that I sing. And then the music that I wrote, the lead guitar parts, all of that stayed with me when other seemingly important things were lost. So it's kind of a compliment to the powers of music that offsets the terror and disappointment of the brain injury.
Now, if I recall correctly, it was when you were coming out of a coma or soon thereafter that a bandmate of yours basically was playing your music to you, and how they kind of saw that your brain activity was kicking in was you were mouthing the words along with the songs. Is that right?
Well, yeah, because, they had all kind of tubes down my throat and some kind of machine helping me breathe, I guess. And I've learned subsequently that fentanyl is part of the medication process here, which may or may not have had something to do with it. But I was just laying there and they didn't know if I was going to live. They didn't know if I was going to die. They didn't know if I had the potential for speaking again or walking again or anything. I was inert. And then the Infidels' first drummer, Jeremy, was visiting, and he held his phone in front of me and played songs from my album that we've been talking about. And then for the first time I showed some hint of life, I started mouthing the words to the song he was playing. And that everyone in the room knew, and the doctors knew from that something was getting through, and that I wasn't going to be a vegetable. Or at least I had a really good chance of not being a vegetable. So it was that musical moment where I sort of flickered back to life, which was the beginning of a process, of course. I'm so happy that it happened that way and that Jeremy was there playing my song to me.
Right. And two, now this accident affected your voice. And so part of your recovery process has been voice lessons now for quite a bit. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, I think over 5 years now, every week I came out of this thing. I remember coming home and picking up a guitar, and I was very sad because I wasn't quite playing right and my voice was just gone. And then maybe it's because of the tubes and such down the throat. It could have been atrophied as well, of course, or just plain brain function. And my weak point was probably vocals all my life anyway. I never really was a singer. And I started doing originals just because I knew I could sing them, because I'd write something I could sing. And like I said, I didn't have to sound like Rod Stewart or anyone else. But this was a big shock for me to be, you know, so bad with the voice. So I got on the internet and I found a man named Paul Fontaine, who has a business called Vocal Mechanics in Green Bay, Wisconsin. And there was an article in the news about how he had helped an injured person recover their voice or something along those lines. So I called him, and it turns out that he was not your average vocal instructor. This guy really knew the science and the physiology of the vocal cords and the throat, and he was good. And I went and visited him. I think I may still have had the headgear because of the broken neck on first time I saw him. And he started working with me, and it just got better and better. I thought I'd go there for a couple of months, and now, 5+ years later, I'm still seeing him every week, and I just keep getting better and better. And boy, I tell you, I would recommend voice lessons from a good coach to anyone in music, because it's worth money. I should have done it when I was 30 years old instead of when I was as old as I am. But now I can confidently sing, the Bon Scott AC/DC cover song if I want to. I can hit the high notes if I want to. And it's like guitar. You have to work at it. And if someone teaches you how and shows you how, you're going to do a lot better than if you're sitting at home just singing along to the radio. So I got to say hats off to Paul Fontaine. I have nothing but respect for him. He's been taught by the best in the business. And I've referred other people to him. My friend Amelia Ford, I referred to him, for example. She sees him when I leave my lesson. She's walking in for hers. It makes me feel good to see people I know that are doing so well also getting the benefit of this magnificent vocal coach. So big, big plus for me. I wouldn't have the good gigs I have right now if it wasn't for Paul Fontaine.
Yeah. Well, one more venture of yours is the Ike Carumba Show, which is live most Tuesday evenings at 8 p.m. Central Time on Code Zero Radio, which listeners can hear at live.codezeroradio.com or with the Code Zero Radio app. Now, what led to you getting this gig, and what can listeners expect to hear when they tune in?
Well, I learned about Code Zero Radio just by probably Facebook posts. I had once performed my band along with a band called Pudge, which was Andy McNamara, and he's one of the DJs. He does an interview program on Code Zero Radio that's very good. He's pretty well known for it. I think he's up for a Whammy Award or a Whammy finalist.
Yes, he is.
For that show right now, as a matter of fact. And I respected Andy. I respected his band. Andy likes my band a lot, which made me feel really good. And I made some comment somewhere. I'm kind of a snarky person. And Bob Minter, who's sort of the local executive in charge at Code Zero Radio, suggested that I might make a good DJ. And, from class clown to trial lawyer to performer, I kind of like a spotlight. And I thought, hey, this could be fun. This is something I could get into. So I told Bob I'd be happy to host the show. And so we set up the Ike Carumba Show. And it's doing pretty well. What I try to do with the Ike Carumba Show, first of all, is play music people aren't going to hear much of anywhere else that's really good music. And that's why you may hear me playing, bands like The Suburbs out of Minneapolis. You don't hear them on the radio. Maybe you did a long time ago somewhat, but not anymore. So in addition to the usual Code Zero Radio indie music and local music angles, I'll go back to the Seattle area and areas that are a little bit unique to me or unique to my age. And, the Hives are a punkish kind of band, and they call regular radio rigor mortis radio, and I get it. It's fun, it's great, it's wonderful, it's popular for a reason, but you're not going to hear a lot of regular radio music on my show. It's not going to be that canned stuff. So first of all, it's about the music. Second of all, it's much about me, my personality, my take on issues, and a fair dose of silliness as well. The effort is to be entertaining and to have fun. And, like I like to say, if my show helps just one person have a happier existence well, then it's been a heck of a waste of time. But I am trying to bring some joy into people's lives, and I'm having a lot of fun with it, too.
Well, there's one more song that I'd like to spin from your album, and this one features Jay Stulo on slide guitar and Amelia Ford duetting with you, and it's called Strange Love Thing. Now, you had mentioned it before that it had seen some chart action down in Australia. What did you bribe Jay and Amelia with to get them to participate?
Well, I don't know what makes you think I had to bribe them. I mean, I got people standing in line to perform with me, but you're right, I did have to bribe them. Jay Stulo, you know, Jay knew me really first as a chimp, me, the chimp, not him. And he actually met me face to face when we were both performing in a band called The Blasters. I was playing bass guitar and he was playing a regular, you know, lead guitar. And I wrote this song and I wanted to have kind of a slide guitar thing in it that would be a little bit unconventional. And of course I thought of Jay because he's pretty much Mr. Slide Guitar in these parts. And he's also a nice, amiable sort of fellow. So what Jay got out of this, really, he got a fine bottle of single malt scotch and a completely illegally enlarged $20 bill. I mean, I had this $20 bill blown up to like 2 feet across, you know, which is not legal at all. But, you know, rock and roll is anti-establishment, right? So we got to stick it to the man. So now there's a picture out there somewhere of me, you know, shaking Jay's hand and handing him this ridiculously large $20 bill, you know, because it was, you know, the biggest bribe ever paid in Rock Garden studio history. So we basically took cash and booze is what does the job with Jay. Mark Goldie, by the way, he's strictly a cash and carry kind of guy. You know, he's hard to bribe. He just goes by the book, although I think he gives me a deal now. As for Amelia, Amelia is probably above blackmail. She's kind of a girl next door, and you can't threaten her with, you know, revealing anything. I was lucky enough to have bumped into Amelia before she became famous. She was someplace called Huckleberry Acres or Huckleberry Hound Sandbox or something. It was an open mic thing. And I had done a couple of tunes and, you know, everyone was absolutely astounded with my skill level. And she got up there and did a great job and she's sitting alone. So I came up and, you know, talked to her a little bit and told her, you know, I thought that she had a lot of potential, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, she's young enough to be my daughter. And then one day I was thinking duet is a cool thing to do. You don't hear a lot of duets. They're not always easy to write, although you might think they are. And so I sat down and just did a masterful job. You know, I kind of adopted this somewhat dopey tone. And I was thinking about Patrick McDonald. And not that he's dopey, not that he sounds dopey, but for some reason I thought, what would he do? And I can't, she is a sweetest thing. And I started mumbling it out and put together this cute little well-written song. And I called Amelia up because I figured, you know, that just based on my songwriting skills and on stage acumen that she'd be absolutely delighted to perform with me. And that's probably not the reason, but she said, sure, right away. And she got together with me a couple of times and we went over the song and she was just a pleasure to work with. So it really is a function of her just being nice, I think, is why it worked out. I didn't have to give her booze and illegally enlarged money like with Jay Stulo.
Yeah, the one thing that I think is very cool is that you helped launch Amelia's recording career, you know, and then last year, look what happened. She brings home the whammy for Album of the Year for her debut album. And, you know, that's all on you.
Yeah, and, you know, during the tearful acceptance speech, I think she forgot to say was, you know, to send money to Ike. This is all Ike. But I forgive her for that. I understand it, the moment, the heat of the moment, the joy of the moment. But I'm just delighted with her success. I'm so happy because, you know, she deserves it. So many jerks rise to the top, and she's not a jerk. And she doesn't, you know, put out the pompous, egomaniacal stuff that I like to throw out there for kicks. So more power to her. But she's performed with me and my band one time where it was a Stubborn Brothers Brewery. We were both playing that day, I think, and she got up to do Strange Love Thing with me. And I'll never forget that I screwed up the PA and forgot the last line of my own song. Other than that, it was fun. But yeah, she deserves to do well. So and she is doing well, so good for her.
Absolutely.
And Jay Stuhl's no slouch either, by the way. He's doing pretty well, too.
And they're two of my favorite musicians here in the Valley. Can't say enough about them.
Last time I saw Jay Stuhl, you were sitting at the table with me. Remember, I joined you.
Absolutely. That was a good time and a great gig. Well, let's listen to you, Jay and Amelia, with Strange Love Thing.
She is the sweetest thing from the deep of the South, with an alligator smile and a Mississippi mouth, and I love her.
Yes, you do.
And if I do her wrong, she'll throw me out. But I love her.
Like you do.
Sometimes love is strange. Don't ask me to explain. If they had a track laid out, we'd jump the train.
Well, Ike, thanks for taking the time to be on the show today. And before we go, where can folks find you online, buy or stream your music, and get your gigging schedule?
One place they can go to is ReverbNation.com and look up the band Ike Arumba and the Infidels. There's a lot of the original music on there. There are original songs that are not on the CD there. I believe they can be purchased through that route. You can always go to my Facebook page for Ike Arumba or the Facebook page for Ike Arumba and the Infidels and see what's going on. We play relatively regularly in the central Wisconsin area mostly. And what would make me happiest is if you found a way to get down to one of our gigs and just show up, say hi, and party with me.
Sounds good. And also before we go, I want to make mention that you are an Into the Music subscriber, and has it enriched your life at all?
Oh, yes. You know, it comes around, goes around. And, you know, I pay a little bit of money every month automatically on a credit card. And first of all, it just makes me feel good because I am, you know, not a major label corporate music kind of guy. And here you are slugging away at the indie level, and many hands make light the work. You know, if 300 people out there even did the minimum contribution every month, it would make a significant difference. And these are quality of life issues to me, music. So I'm proud and happy to support Into the Music. And maybe someone will hear this and join me.
Thank you, Ike. I appreciate it.
It's been my pleasure.
Thank you. Well, my guest today has been attorney, guitarist, bassist, radio show host, and half chimp, Ike Arumba. Well, check out the Ike Arumba Show with the Code Zero radio app, where you can hear most of his recent shows and everything back to show number one, if I'm not mistaken.
That is correct.
Join me next time when my guest will be Ryan Patrick, otherwise known as Rasta Ryan, who fronts the reggae band Luminati. Now, if you've been to a Luminati gig, you know that these guys are incredible, and Ryan's going to tell us all about what they're up to. Thanks for listening, and please share Into the Music with your friends and on your socials. We really appreciate it when you give the show that signal boost. And don't forget, you can always hear every episode and support the show on our website at intothemusic.com. That's in the number two, themusic.com. So long for now, and we'll see you next time we get into the music.
Thank you for joining us on this episode of Into the Music. Find us on Facebook, Instagram, YouTube, and Odyssey.com. Drop us a line on our socials or email us at intothemusic@newprojectx.com. To support Into the Music, go to buymeacoffee.com/intothemusic. Your support keeps the show going and is always greatly appreciated. This show is copyright 2024 Project X Productions. Join us next time we get into the music. God bless and take care, everybody.